From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the confessions of a bad boy. At least that's how Ben Sonnenberg describes himself in his new memoir. Sonnenberg grew up in a house crammed with antiques, art, and servants. He hated it. He later used his inheritance to start the literary magazine Grand Street, a magazine he gave up when he could no longer turn its pages because of advanced multiple sclerosis. Also today, as Frontline prepares for its 10th season, we talk with its executive producer, David Fanning, about getting controversial investigative documentaries on TV. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Soviet government has a new foreign minister tonight. Boris Ponkin, currently the Soviet ambassador to Czechoslovakia, has been chosen to replace Alexander Besmertnik, who was fired last week for his allegedly passive response to the attempted coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Moscow.
Boris Ponkin was one of only a handful of Soviet diplomats around the world who denounced the coup attempt right from the start. Other Soviet ambassadors went along, even to the point of removing Gorbachev's picture from their embassy walls. Ponkin's selection, however, came as a bit of a surprise. The favorite candidate was Edward Shevardnadze, who resigned as foreign minister last December to protest what he said were signs of a coming dictatorship. Shevardnadze was the Soviet foreign minister during the period when East and West Germany unified, when the people of Eastern Europe rose up against their communist regimes, and when agreements were negotiated that led to the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Eastern Europe. Mikhail Gorbachev reportedly discussed the possibility of Shevardnadze's appointment with him. The fact he was not chosen has prompted speculation that Gorbachev may propose Shevardnadze as his next vice president. I'm Tom Jelton in Moscow.
Soviet Black Beret Special Forces troops in Latvia threatened violence today unless they're granted amnesty and guaranteed safe passage out of the republic. The Interior Ministry troops have been accused of intimidation attacks against nationalist forces in the Baltic republics. In January, the troops raided the Latvian Interior Ministry in Riga, leaving 5 people dead. About 150 Black Berets signed a statement warning of bloodshed if they and their families are not allowed to leave the republic peacefully. They promised to lay down their arms if the amnesty is granted. A congressional report issued today has thrown doubt on the Navy's claims that it was sabotage that caused the explosion on the battleship Iowa that killed 47 sailors. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
According to the General Accounting Office, a panel of civilian scientists was unable to determine whether the explosion in the turret of the battleship was deliberately caused or was an accident. The Navy, after an investigation, initially concluded that Gunner's mate Clayton Hartwig set off the blast in an act of suicidal desperation. However, according to the GAO report, there is no explicit physical evidence that an ignition device was present in the center gun of turret 2 at the time of the explosion. Investigators said that the 1989 blast could have been caused by improperly ramming powder bags into the chamber of the 16-inch gun. The Navy's own report is due out in the next few weeks. Hartwig's family has sued the Navy for $40 million, and it's widely believed the service may back away from its initial finding. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 29 points to close at a new record, 3,055. This is NPR. The National Association of Counties warned today that county governments across the country are facing a fiscal crisis. The organization reported that 40% of counties with populations of more than 100,000 people are facing budget deficits. 70% of the more populous counties in California, Maryland, and New York are facing shortfalls. County officials blamed the deficits on federal and state governments, claiming that they've passed on obligations to local governments without providing a means to pay for them. Department of Energy officials are in Oak Ridge, Tennessee today, holding public hearings on a proposal to build a new centralized nuclear weapons complex there. Halloran Hill reports.
Greenpeace activists from as far away as Colorado were on hand today with words of warning about the proposal.
Rocky Flats has had repeated environmental problems. Health problems are not yet fully identified. And we don't want the people of Tennessee to be faced with those same health problems that the people of Colorado have faced.
Hugh Christie is with the local electricians union. He wants the plant.
I've worked in the Wye Trail plant since 1951, and I know that we can do it safe. I think our country needs it. We have the technology, we have the expertise here in engineering, and we have the craftsmen that can do the job.
More than 300 area residents will address the panel today and tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Halloran Hill reporting.
A peace conference among the leading factions in the Cambodian civil war was deadlocked today in disagreements over disarmament, elections, and human rights. Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who was chosen as chairman of the meeting, said he doubted that the session would end with a comprehensive agreement. Yesterday, there were indications that the disarmament issue could be resolved. All parties agreed to reduce their armies by 70%. Sihanouk said that a disagreement has arisen over the government's refusal to include a special police force in the troop reductions. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben Sonnenberg grew up in the kind of mansion many people fantasize about. It was 19 Gramercy Park, which The New Yorker once described as unquestionably the greatest house remaining in private hands in New York. It was crammed with servants, antique furniture, and art. The family money was made by Ben's father, who became one of the creators of modern public relations. In 1981, Ben Sonnenberg used his inheritance to start the literary magazine Grand Street, which he edited for 9 years. Now he's written a memoir called Lost Property about growing up rich and unhappy. It's also about love, sex, marriage, literature, and how a life can be changed by sickness. Sonnenberg has multiple sclerosis, which has advanced to the point where he can no longer move his arms or legs. We invited him to talk with us about his life and his memoir. It turns out, while he was growing up in the home of our dreams, he dreamed about living someplace else.
My fantasies were directed entirely to living in an apartment and having an elevator and not having staircases and being able to eat white bread and things like that.
What didn't you like about the mansion?
The thing that I didn't like about it was having to answer that question all the time. I was so visibly unhappy. And the notion of being so unhappy and so rich is a disturbing one. The temptation to invite a poor, a little rich boy feelings is one I wished always to resist and have. What I liked best about the house were the spaces and the kind of fantasies it permitted. But I didn't like being at the distance that any sort of moneyed upbringing puts you from your mother and father.
Well, you're right. My father had a compulsion to buy, my mother to decorate. Together, they made a fetish of antique furniture. Would you describe a little bit what the house you grew up in looked like?
It looked like an abridgment of a very great, very well established old bourgeois house in Paris or in London, with aristocratic leanings and wealth visible everywhere. I mean, everywhere you turned, and the uniform nature of the impression that the house made, where there was perfection in every detail, even when you opened the drawers, even if you looked in the linen closet, even if you looked in where the food was prepared and all. It was of a... there were lots and lots of servants. And the... let me see how it can be compared to a really superbly run hotel in an aristocratic resort of some sort.
What's ironic about this is that your parents were not aristocrats from old money. Your father was a Russian Jewish immigrant who made his money as like the king of public relations in the United States. And public relations is, you know, a very forward kind of occupation where you have to be a little hyperbolic in your language and kind of pushy. So it's like the work he did that made the money is so much the opposite of the sensibility in the house.
Except that the house was a fraud. The house was decorated and maintained in obedience to the dictum of my father's, which was always to live better than your clients.
That's pretty funny. What kind of sense of money and how to spend money did you grow up with?
That no word was more offensive to my parents, my father particularly, than wholesale. My mother said of my father that he would walk across the street to get something if he heard it was more expensive there.
So did you spend money foolishly yourself?
I spent money extravagantly.
Yeah, I think that's the word I was looking for.
No, I don't think, but I don't think of extravagance as foolish for someone like me. I think if you have more money than you need, the only thing to do with it is give it away. I mean, throw it off the back of a train.
Well, that's not exactly what you did. What did you do with the money?
I bought presents, and as soon as I was, and I bought books, and I bought records, and as soon as I was able to, I got out of the house and lived in Europe, traveling as much as I could and also chasing as much skirt as I could.
You know, a lot of people say that one of the problems that the sons and daughters of the wealthy have is that they don't have the incentive that needing to make a living brings. So that...
Oh, that is so frequent a reproach of my father's to me, that I didn't have fire in my belly, that I never knew what hunger was. And as this was part of the tyranny, you know, of a formerly poor parent. But there is no reason for someone with money to lack incentive. It usually comes from mother, and my reproach against my mother is that nothing came from her in that way.
E.F. said, though, in your memoir that living with all expenses paid was debilitating.
Yes. And it's debilitating, especially when you're when you compare yourself to others who earn a living, I mean, one's contemporaries who do, and so on. On the other hand, I don't think there is anything to be said against. I don't think there's anything to be said for not having money.
You've had multiple sclerosis, MS, for the past few years. How long have you had it?
It began in the early 70s, so I've had it for 20 years. And it's a progressive disease, so that now I am quadriplegic. When I started the magazine, I could still turn pages of a book. Now I can't.
There's a terrific review of your memoir in the Voice Literary Supplement, and the review is written by Jane Mendelsohn. And she describes you in this review as a brilliant aesthete, an aesthete being a person having sensitivity to beauty. I think of an aesthete as somebody who kind of lives in their senses, too, who's like just so absorbed in sensuality and in art. And I'm thinking, you know, one of the things you can do with MS is still live in the senses and still be just totally immersed in art of all forms. And I'm just wondering if you feel like that part of you remains really unaffected by the disease.
I don't really want to talk about that. I'm not a spokesman for people with MS, and I even resent supposing that it should take away or enhance my sensitivity. It hasn't made me a better person, as illness is supposed to do.
I think you're implying there that you really don't like a lot of the literature of illness that talks about all the heightened emotions and deep insensitivities and stuff that resulted from the illness.
You bet I don't. If I could wave my hand, I would say it even more emphatically. I don't like it, and I don't like illness being a subject of interest, and I wish to get back to the book, and particularly to the writing of the book, which is what I care about. I mean, the quality of the writing of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get back to something that you raised in the book that I found in a way very amusing. You've been immersed in books all your life. And you've collected thousands and thousands of books over the years. But you write that a love of literature, that your love of literature was begun in masturbation and was always linked to pornography. I found that kind of humorous, since people try so hard to keep their children away from pornography. And you're kind of celebrating it here as what really got you very involved with literature.
The pornography is a powerful incentive to read. I mean, I wouldn't have learned, I don't think I'd have learned Latin if I hadn't wanted to read the dirty parts of Catullus and Juvenal and Martial.
You couldn't find English translations of the dirty parts?
Not then, you couldn't.
Oh.
Not in the 50s.
The part of your life that, to me, fits least in the memoir, you know, if you ask yourself what doesn't fit into this picture, it's the part where you were working for the CIA?
My motives for doing that were to get out of the draft. Also, it seemed to me to be a mischievous thing to do. And also, it seemed to me to be an irresistible thing to do for someone who had spent a lifetime of lying and keeping secrets from people.
What was your typical assignment?
My typical assignment really was to report on what I heard. What I did was really trivial. But then the work of the CIA in general was pretty trivial.
My guest is Ben Sonnenberg. His new memoir is called Lost Property, Memoirs and Confessions of a Bad Boy. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Ben Sonnenberg, and he was the founder and editor of the literary magazine Grand Street, and he's written a memoir called Lost Property, Memoirs and Confessions of a Bad Boy. I think what you've become best known for in the past few years is the literary magazine Grand Street, which you founded, edited, and published for, well, close to 10 years. You founded it in the early 1980s. What was the occasion for starting a literary magazine? You'd loved literature all your life.
I inherited, as I say in the book, a foundation and the idea of capital appreciating is so revolting to me that I wanted to give the money of the foundation away as quickly as I could, and doing it through the medium of a magazine, paying writers well and producing a good-looking, though not excessively expensive magazine on the European model, was attractive to me.
But you eventually ran out of money for Grand Street, didn't you?
Sort of.
Did that make you wish that you'd spent it differently more, or had accumulated more capital so that you could keep it running longer?
No, I was glad that the magazine stopped when it did. I don't think that a literary magazine has, I mean, I think it has a term. You know, I hate to think of institutionalizing a magazine like Grand Street, which owed its quality to something gestural, you know, something thrown away, something more like a wave of the hand than of building an institution.
Did giving up the magazine have more to do with running out of money or more to do with the progress of the MS?
I think probably more to do with the MS, but as I say, I was glad to stop. I was glad in a way to stop. I write of missing not having around me the many young women I had who worked on the magazine. It's not hard to make up for.
Since you've had this kind of peculiar relationship with money all your life, and by peculiar I mean you've had a lot of it, but you seem to have this real need for it and distaste for it at the same time. I'm wondering how much money you have now, and I don't mean like how much money is in your bank account in dollars and cents. But...
Oh, fortunately, what I was left was left to me in trust, so I don't have to worry about spending my children's tuitions or what is alarming is to find that because of the needs of someone with MS who lives at home and not in an institution is how the expenses pile up incredibly, unforeseeably. I wish I'd had money enough to be indifferent to that. Also to be able to send my wife and dog on vacation as they are now for the first time in I don't know how many years.
Let me ask you about the experience of writing the memoir. I think any time you write a memoir and you're looking back, you see a different self because it's the self that's younger, you know, a self from a completely different period of history as well as a different period of social history. But for you, it also meant looking back at a time when you were unencumbered by MS. And I'm just wondering about like some of the emotions you went through in looking back on your life and writing the book.
Oh, it's so affecting to think of walking and of making love and courting and going to the theater and in general just the trying to think of a suitable word for the just sauntering, you know. It was very affecting indeed. And but that together with how badly, how rudely I behaved to everyone.
You had said before in the interview that you really don't like the literature of illness that you've read, you know, especially like the literature that talks about the new sensitivity and awareness that the illness has brought and so on. And you don't really spend a lot of time in your memoir talking about your own illness. And in a way, I think I'm interested to know why you didn't want to use your memoir as an opportunity to write about illness in a different way than you've read about it. I mean, you have written about it, but it's considering it's been a part of your life for about 20 years, there's not that much time in the memoir spent on it.
I wanted to write a book that ended cheerfully. I didn't want to. I mean, it's a disgusting and angering condition to be in. It's bad enough to get older. I mean, it's really terrible. But to get older and be sick and dependent on others after a lifetime of after a lifetime of dependence is, it's terrible. It's very bad luck.
You know, I'm wondering, we talk so much about the mansion that you grew up in and how when you were young, you really envied people who had an elevator and an apartment building. What kind of place do you live in now?
An elevator building with the doorman and people downstairs a regular apartment.
In Manhattan?
In Manhattan, on Riverside Drive.
I have one last question for you, and it's about your books. Do you still have thousands of them, and where do you keep them?
I have maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand. I keep them in my apartment. Do I read them? No, I can't read except with assistance. Now, it's infuriating. I particularly have many dictionaries, and I love reading dictionaries.
Is there someone you could hire to help you read? Is that a consideration?
Oh, I have a number of people who help me read for pay. Yes. But mostly I talk and listen to the radio.
Ben Sonnenberg's memoir is called Lost Property, Memoirs and Confessions of a Bad Boy. It's published by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The commercial networks have virtually given up on the hour-long documentary, but David Fanning hasn't. Coming up, we meet the executive producer of Frontline, Public Television's controversial documentary series, which is about to enter its 10th season. Back in the 1950s, saxophonist Tab Smith cut a lot of ballads for Chicago's United Records. Now they're being reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us why they're worth a second listen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev has named a new foreign minister and ordered a shakeup in the KGB. The Soviet president named Boris Pankin as Soviet foreign minister. Pankin was one of the few Soviet ambassadors who did not follow the orders of the hardline coup leaders during the coup attempt last week. In the meantime, prosecutors have charged 13 suspected ringleaders of the takeover with high treason. Meanwhile, delegations from the Russian and Soviet parliament are now in the Ukraine for urgent talks with that republic's leaders. Kevin Conley of the BBC says the speed with which the talks were arranged is an indication of how seriously political leaders are taking the possibility of conflict.
The hasty departure of the delegations for Kiev is an indication that the Soviet Union's politicians are scrambling to keep up with the pace of events. The Ukraine, seizing the opportunity presented by the collapse of the coup, has declared itself to be independent. That declaration is viewed with some suspicion by radicals in Moscow. They believe communists in the Ukrainian government may be supporting it in the hope of preventing the spread of new and liberal ideas from Russia. The talks are likely to focus on a statement issued by Mr. Yeltsin's staff, which said Russia might seek revisions of its borders with neighboring republics which were home to large Russian communities if they didn't join the reformed union. Mr. Yeltsin, though, has indicated that the two republics have sorted out at least one contentious issue. He said the Ukraine, which wants to become nuclear-free, has agreed that the Russian Federation should take back the Soviet missiles, which are now based on its territory.
Kevin Conley of the BBC. In Washington, the Commerce Department announced today that the nation's gross national product moved down instead of up. At his summer home in Maine, President Bush said that he was not troubled by the drop in the GNP. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting has more.
The president told reporters as he set off for another round of golf this afternoon that he's not worried by revised figures showing the GNP dropped 0.1% in the second quarter.
There are some statistics up and some down, but basically I think it's doing all right.
The president said the figures do not mean the nation is still in a recession. The Commerce Department released the GNP numbers this morning, revising an earlier report that had shown the economic indicator improving just a bit. On another domestic subject, the president said he was satisfied with the American Bar Association's rating of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas as qualified. The rating is not the ABA's best, but Mr. Bush noted it was the same rating Thomas got when he was nominated to the Federal Appeals Court. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 29 points to close at a new record high of 3,055.23. on volume of some 170 million shares. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, as Croatian and Serbian forces fought for control of a town in the eastern part of the nation, federal leaders called for an end to the violence. According to Belgrade television, about 30 people have been killed in the latest fighting, and federal airplanes and guns struck hard at Croatian positions. Officials in the breakaway republic have accused the federal army of backing Serbian rebels in major battles, a charge denied by army officials. As the latest ceasefire broke down, officials decided earlier this week to try and gain another truce. The standoff between federal officials and Cuban detainees at a federal prison in Alabama has now entered its second week. Inmates are still holding 10 hostages in a section of the prison, and for a second day they are using banners made out of bedsheets to get messages across to the media. Debbie Elliott of member station WUAL reports.
Cuban detainees erected two new banners atop Alpha Unit today. In one, the inmates say they are hungry for freedom, and in the other, they ask to meet with two reporters and a Cuban independence activist from Miami. Prison spokesman Dan Dunn won't comment on the banners, but does report routine medical attention was provided to two inmates and one hostage earlier today.
The medication was given, as far as we know at this point in time. That hostage is in stable condition.
Dunn says water and electricity are still being provided to Alpha Unit, but no food has been delivered in since the takeover began. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Talladega, Alabama.
Officials of U.S. Air say that talks are now underway with Continental Airlines, but would not say if they are merger talks. Continental has been operating under bankruptcy protection since the end of last year and indicated in May that it might be interested in a merger. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The PBS investigative documentary series, Frontline, begins its 10th season this fall. It's public TV's highest-rated public affairs program. Since the series began, no subject has been too complex or controversial for Frontline to tackle. Frontline premiered with an investigation into the connections between the NFL, sports gambling, and organized crime. More recently, Frontline has investigated the October surprise, sexual abuse at a daycare center, the Noriega connection, and the CIA's involvement with drug smugglers. David Fanning is the series creator and executive producer. I asked him if there are certain subjects he knows will generate an angry response.
We don't actually get a great deal of angry response. Sometimes people will write letters because they just object to the idea of us reporting Iran-Contra at all, having pulled together a massive chronology of the Iran-Contra affair called High Crimes and Misdemeanors. We did, in effect, the definitive television telling of that story. And the one or two letters would come in and say, why don't you leave this alone, and why don't you stop beating this dead horse, etc. But those are not serious responses, because it was an intelligent and carefully wrought piece of journalism.
Conservative media watchdog groups have described Frontline as being too liberal. What do you tell them when they say that?
Well, we also point to them that every now and then there are also programs on Frontline that the left is not always happy with. We're prepared to call the shots as we see them. I think it's more a reflection of the fact that we will ask hard questions of the present administration and the past administrations. Both of them have been conservative Republican administrations, and inevitably, when you ask hard questions of people in power, we would be doing that equally if it were a Democratic administration. We think we're fair, and we think we're asking the tough questions about the stories of our times.
Can you give us a sense of what the process is like, of how you decide what subject you're going to cover, who's going to be the reporter to work on it, who's going to be the narrator, if that's a person who's different from the reporter, you know?
We send people out on research trips, initial research trips. Our producers are, in effect, journalists who work with camera crews. They work sometimes in conjunction with an investigative reporter, but more often they do the basic journalism themselves. And so they go out into an area. For example, when we went looking at the prosecution of child abuse cases, we began to look at a number of cases, and Ofra Bikel, the producer, started in New Jersey, I think went to Nashville, Tennessee, found another case somewhere else, and finally came through a small town in Eatonton, North Carolina, and paused there, spent a bit more time, began to talk to people, came back and said, it's extremely hard, nobody wants to talk about it. But it's a fascinating case, and if we go back, we have no guarantee we'll ever be able to film. We could spend a long time and still get no access. And so we make a gamble at that point that we will indeed send her back there. And she spent as long as 3 months in the town getting to know people and finally gaining access, in the end making a very complex and powerful film called Innocence Lost, which was only the result of a long investment of time. So that's the beginning of the process. It's finding particular stories. We put a high premium on a single narrative story, one place, as opposed to the kind of sort of white paper idea of gathering a lot of different stories together and knitting them together with didactic reporting. So we tend to find a single story, look for the narrative, and dig in deep and find truth in the details. So that's the long process of research. That research will move into shooting, filming, which could take anything from a couple of weeks in some cases to over a period of months in other cases. And then the process of editing, which could take, in the case of a very fast turnaround, a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, and in the complex film, more like 3 to 4 months to edit.
My guest is David Fanning, the executive producer of the PBS documentary series Frontline. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is David Fanning, the executive producer of Frontline, Public Television's documentary and investigative series. Why do you think so much of television has basically given up on the documentary? I'm talking about the extended documentary. It's basically been given up on commercial television.
Well, I think that they made a fundamental mistake about how to make it. I think there's some...
How to make the documentary?
How to make the documentaries. I think that there are two great strands of documentaries in this country. One is the television documentary, which has a very particular grammar of its own, and the non-narrative verite, more often verite documentary, which has been the world of film festivals and the independent filmmakers. And those two worlds very rarely met, and they haven't really cross-fertilized each other. Television documentaries on networks are an extension of news reporting. They are shot in much the same way. They are constructed with some of the same grammars. They tend to be broken up by commercials too. They don't have a chance to really build a continuing narrative. They tend to be episodic. The classic television documentary has four families and four stories from four different parts of the country with some expert stuck between and a correspondent with a microphone on camera occasionally. A Frederick Wiseman or an independent filmmaker who gets deep into a particular piece of Appalachian culture or wherever and follows with a camera is a very different creature. And what we've tried to do is actually see how to join those two together.
You were the co-producer, co-writer of what turned out to be a very controversial show in, I think it was 1980 on public television, The Death of a Princess. And I think a lot of our listeners might remember this. It was the story of a Saudi Arabian princess who was executed because she had an extramarital affair. And it was done as a docudrama since you really couldn't get, I mean, she was dead and a lot of other people. So obviously you couldn't talk with her and you couldn't talk with a lot of the other people on camera either. Is that why you did it as a docudrama?
Yes, it was a fascinating journey, actually, because we started off having been told a story about somebody who believed they knew something about her, and we went on a conventional research trip, if you will, to talk to those people, and we talked to a lot of people as we went along, and recorded them on a small audio tape, just for the record and to have material to go back and to look to and listen and to sort out as we came back from the research period. And along the way realized, of course, that none of these people would ever talk on camera in a documentary fashion. Their lives would be threatened. They felt unable to do that. And so came back somewhat perplexed, but looked at this great volume of material, these transcripts of these audio tapes, and realized that in that lay a fascinating story, which was in two levels. On the one level, it was the pursuit of the facts about what really happened, because the story we'd originally been told turned out not to be true. But along the way, each person had some smidgen of evidence that added to the story. But on another level, you found that they were talking not so much about her, but about themselves. And so a Jordanian woman who tells the story of how she left her smothering family to run away with the man she loved, and how a young cousin was sent after her to supposedly kill her and didn't have the guts for it, told a story really about herself. And so each of those people, it became a journey into the private center of the Arab world. And we realized that the way to do it was to take these transcripts and to cut them down, and for those cut, edited transcripts to in effect become the film, and to have a fictional journalist, an actor in this case, travel through the heart of the Arab world talking to people. And in each case, we used mostly amateurs to play the part of people, because we changed their description somewhat. We would change them in age and location to protect them. But it was still, the heart of it was still the real words that were told by real people.
When the death of a princess was supposed to be broadcast, there was a lawsuit by a group of Saudi lawyers, Saudi Arabian lawyers. It was a class action suit. And the idea was to prevent the program from being broadcast, right?
I think they tried to sue us, actually, for a class action suit on behalf of 700 million Muslims. We had
For misrepresenting them?
Misrepresenting Islam, which is ironic, actually, because I think the film was very, very careful about Islam and very respectful of Islamic law, because the point of the film, and I think the point of outrage on the part of the Saudi royal family about the film, was the fact that the film drew closer to the conclusion that the girl had been executed not under Islamic law, but as an act of tribal justice. Because under the Sharia, the Quranic code of law, to prove adultery is very, very hard. The Prophet was very clear about this. The Prophet said that it would take 3 independent and honorable male witnesses, or 6 independent and honorable female witnesses, to the actual act to prove adultery. So clearly it's impossible to prove unless the person admits 3 times, and each time after the clear warning by the judge, the consequences of their admission, that they were in fact guilty of adultery. So it's something that never really actually happens. And it was clear as the story emerged that the girl and her lover, a foolish young woman who had fallen in love with a young man in this society in Saudi Arabia, had been made an example of by her grandfather, who was the king's elder brother, and had been brought by his bodyguards into a parking lot in downtown Jeddah, and they put a pile of sand in one corner of it and made her kneel, and had him watch as she was shot. That was her prerogative as a royal princess, and he was then beheaded rather badly by one of the prince's bodyguards. It was not a formal execution, and it was not done. So in effect, we were accusing a senior member of the Saudi royal family of breaking the law and of murder. So that was the heart of the controversy. It was never couched in those terms.
So were you sued before or after the broadcast?
Well, we were sued after the broadcast, but it was thrown out as a nuisance suit. It was a nonsense suit. But it was a group of Saudi lawyers who were trying to ingratiate themselves with the kingdom.
What did you learn about lawsuits and controversy from this experience over a decade ago?
Well, I learned that controversy takes a great deal out of you, that it's very, very hard. You make a very particular decision to make a controversial film, and that it requires a great deal of work on your own as you go through it to hold up against criticism. It was not hard in the case of Death of a Princess, because I really believed in the film. There was no question about the factual basis of the film, although we were being attacked about the facts and that this was an invention and a fiction. We were very, very clear about what it was, because we understood clearly about what we were doing. So I was very comfortable about defending the film, and that's the heart of it. I think you can stand up to any controversy if you believe in your material, if you believe in what you're saying, and if you believe in the essential integrity of it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Fanning is the executive producer of the PBS series Frontline. Frontline begins its 10th anniversary season in October with a profile of Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what stories do you have from the Soviet Union?
Well, we'll be hearing about the naming of a new foreign minister for the Soviet Union. That came on a day when the entire cabinet was sacked by an action of the Supreme Soviet. We'll also be hearing about plans to reform the Soviet economy, tales of burning documents and files underneath the KGB headquarters, some reflections from Soviet experts Murray Feshbach and Marshall Goldman, and in addition to that, we'll also be hearing news of the subway crash in New York City today and the roots of the conflict in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, between Hasidic Jews and blacks who live there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new reissue by the late alto saxophonist Tab Smith called Jump Time. In the 1930s and 40s, Smith played with the big bands of Count Basie and Lucky Millinder, and also recorded with Billie Holiday. By the 50s, he was known as a strong rhythm and blues player. Kevin says the situations Smith played in might have changed, but his style stayed the same.
Tab Smith came out of the great tradition of swing-era alto saxophonists like Willie Smith, no relation, and the Ellington Band's Johnny Hodges, players whose sounds drip with sensuality. Tab Smith's sweet tenderness made him an ideal ballad player. By 1951, Smith had more than two decades of work behind him, as a sideman and as a leader, and he'd given up his full-time career in music to sell real estate in St. Louis. But then he recorded the ballad we just heard some of, Because of You. It reportedly sold 250,000 copies and put him back in the music biz. It's on a new collection of singles Smith recorded for the small United label in the early 1950s. The CD is the first in a series of Smith's United recordings due out from Chicago's Delmark label. Jump blues was a style that reflected the changes in pop music happening in the late 40s and early 50s. It blurs the lines between jazz, R&B, and rock and roll. Tab Smith waxed a lot of ballads for the jukebox trade back then, but at least as good as the ballads were the blues he taped for their flip sides. It might seem strange that elegant alto players like Smith and Johnny Hodges were invariably great blues players, too. At least, it'll seem strange if you think of the blues as rough-hewn music that revels in bad times. But the blues is really about defiance of rough living and triumph over adversity. Tab Smith's suave playing celebrates grace under pressure. Smith was also a part-time singer whose vocal style was pitched halfway between crooning ballads and confessional blues. According to one exec at his record company, Smith didn't get much of a chance to sing on 45 releases because sales dipped when certain listeners discovered he was black. Maybe so, but his singing owed more to Bing Crosby than to blues shouters.
I tried to be fair, to prove that I care. And now I realize too late. You said that night, it's love at first sight. Now how can you say we're through?
Tab Smith's singing is pleasant enough, but it doesn't have the spine-shivering quality of his alto playing. Now, you might find his saxophone style cloying as corn syrup, but everybody likes some sweet stuff once in a while. And if you're partial to music in that vein, you might as well listen to someone who can really play.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the new Tab Smith reissue, Jump Time, on the Delmark label. So, talk to us about Fresh Air. We have a toll-free listener line for you to call and leave your comments about our show. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Burden directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester, and it's performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor and director Kenneth Branagh. His film adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry V was nominated for an Oscar as Best Picture. His new movie, Dead Again, is set in two different eras, and Branagh plays two different parts. Also, we meet saxophonist David Sanborn. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.